critique of Conrad Lawrence's thinking, which was very influential, not only on Nico Tinbergen, I mean, Conrad Lawrence's co-Nobel laureate, but also very much on sort of the Dutch and the British ethologists. And Robert Hind, who was my supervisor, was very much influenced by Dan Lehman's critique. And another well-known figure in this area was Gilbert Gottlieb, who died fairly recently. He got all of his ideas from a very interesting Chinese psychologist, Kuo. But I mean, these people were very critical of kind of the Lawrence ideas. But despite all that, there was a kind of a germ of truth in what Conrad Lawrence said, and he had not really properly embraced the ideas of development, and Lehman, in his critique, made the point that in the course of development, there's a continuous interaction between the developing organism and its genes and its environment, and he saw development very much in those terms. Lawrence, though, did make a very important point in a fairly early paper. He said that when we look at species in the wild, we can easily recognize different species. I mean, obviously, sometimes there's confusion, but on the whole, the field guides should get very good, and they enable you to identify plants, birds. And in this study, Lawrence used the behavior, in this case, of ducks, to classify the ducks. And so in a sense, there was something very robust about the behavior and the characteristics of those animals. If we take a more modern study, this is work done by Kent Berridge on the grooming of rodents. And if you watch a young rodent grooming, it has a very characteristic movement of its paws when it's washing its face. It'll move its paws in an elliptical movement like that. And you can measure the duration of the ellipse. And if you do that for different species, you find that there's a very strong correlation between the body mass of the rodent and the duration of the ellipse. And you might think, well, that's just physics. I mean, if you're bigger, you can move more slowly. But in fact, it's not so. And if you look at, for example, the infant rat, which is much, much smaller than the adult, it's doing it at the same rate. So there's something about the motor pattern which is intrinsic to the organism. And Berridge made a very strong point about that. He did it also in the infant guinea pig, again, the same rate of movement. So here something is very robust and obviously demands our attention. Another famous study done by Eberhard Gwinner on garden warblers. These are small migratory warblers which, in this particular case, were caught when they were still very small, and when they were still nestlings, taken into the laboratory, hand-reared in the laboratory, and kept in cages where you could see how they were moving around the cage. They had a series of perches in the cage, so you could actually see the orientation of the bird. Now, birds which are migratory will become very restless in the autumn, and they will tend to move in a particular part of the cage. And what Gwinner found was that if you look at the map of Europe, he found that they were trying to move in a southwesterly direction. I mean, these birds had never migrated before, but they were orientating towards the southwest. And after about a month, they changed their orientation, which is just as well. I mean, in the real world, it would take about a month for these warblers to get from Germany to Spain. And if they went on in the southwestly direction, it would take them out of the Atlantic. So quite spontaneously, they change their orientation and go down in, as if they were going down into Africa. They're still sitting in Germany, of course, but I mean, there's an intrinsic feature of this behavior, which, again, come the spring, they will fly in a northern direction, as if back to Germany. So, again, a very robust piece of behavior, which might sort of justify a kind of clear category. Another aspect of development which I think is worth emphasising is that if you look at any species, there's a very orderly pattern of development. In the case of the cat, it's born with its eyes closed, but round about 7 to 10 days after birth, the eyes start to open. And then they start to walk about in a rudimentary way 18 to 28 days after birth. They take their first solid food, again at a very regular period, about 28 to 32 days after birth. They start playing with objects. They've been playing with socially, but then they start playing with objects around about 45 to 55 days after birth. And the females become sexually mature at 7 months, and the males become mature a bit later. But again, a very orderly pattern of development. And of course, it's obvious that we humans do the same. I mean, and one very striking thing is if you look at smiling in a baby born at term, at full term, they will start. We will all start to smile at around about 5 to 6 weeks after birth, including blind babies. You don't have to be sighted in order to do this. So again, something very robust that occurs in our own species. Another feature is that a lot of behaviour is quite modular. And this image of the Swiss Army knife has been used to say that there are neural modules which are specific to a particular domain and encapsulated information in it. And to give you a famous example, if you take a condition known as prosopagnosia, where it's very difficult for people who have this condition to recognize faces, and it's known that it's associated with a particular bit of the brain, and if this bit of the brain is destroyed by a tumor or by injury, then the individual develops this inability to recognize faces. And it's going to be very embarrassing for a person like that because they can't even recognize their close relatives. And I'm sorry to actually show this face, but this is to show for us who haven't got prosopagnosia, of course we can easily recognize faces, and we have this remarkable capacity to recognize faces. Now, all these different bits of evidence have led to a variety of criteria being used for innateness and for instinctive behaviour. And one of them, in a way kind of very obvious, is that when something occurs at a particular stage of development, say at birth, or when the individual becomes sexually mature, that is described as being innate. And the etymology of innate is innatus, present at birth. Another characteristic is that it's not learned. A third one is that in some sense it's genetic. Probably the best way of describing it is to say it's highly heritable. A fourth is that it's adapted during evolution. This is something that Conrad Lorenz made a big point about. Fifthly, it can develop before the function is established. And even in the little rodents, which you see wiping their face, they do it even before they got any fur. So the behavior pattern is developed before the function. So again, something which uses a criterion for identifying natures and instinctive behavior. Again, there are patterns of behavior which are shared by all members of the species, or at least all members of the same sex of a species, or all members of the same age group in that species. And again, this is used as a criterion. Another criterion is that it's part of a behavioral system, like feeding or hunting or mating. And a variety of systems in which behavior is organized is used as a way of characterizing innateness and instinctive behavior. Another, as we've seen, is that it's controlled by a specialized neural module. And so, like in face recognition, it seems to be a particular bit of the brain which is concerned with a particular function. And then finally, the behaviour is regarded as developmentally robust in the sense that it's well canalised and protected from environmental input. Now, this is all well and good, but what we find is, as we try to see whether these are things that actually form a tight cluster, they don't. And so there will be some characteristics here which are not correlated with other characteristics. I'll give you some examples in a moment, but I mean, if you say that something's adapted during evolution, doesn't mean to say that it's not learnt. I mean, we have a famous example of behavioural imprinting, which is clearly involves learning, clearly involves plasticity, and yet it's also clearly something which has been adapted during the course of evolution. So these things tend to break apart. They're not all correlated with each other, which means that there doesn't seem to be a kind of unitary concept which we can apply. And I think the general point I want to emphasise is that as scientists, we should say what we've actually discovered, rather than imply that all the other criteria which have been used will be established if we've got evidence just for one of them. It doesn't follow that that's the case. In fact, we know it's not the case. So we should say what we mean rather than use a term which is actually very ambiguous. There are many routes to the robustness, and I'm not going to go into this in detail, but some people emphasise that behaviour can be very robust because the organism is insensitive to the environment. That would be one way in which you get a very consistent pattern of behaviour. There may also be constraints on development, so that, again, it's protected from environmental influences and therefore becomes very robust. It can also be the case that systems can be very redundant, and just as they would be in an aeroplane or something like that, where your life depends on it. If something breaks down, you don't immediately crash. And we have some very clear examples where, for example, you establish a clear link between a gene and a behavior pattern, and then you knock out that gene, and the behavior pattern still develops. I mean, so there can be different routes to the same endpoint. So the redundancy in the developmental system can be very remarkable. There can be repair mechanisms, particularly at the molecular level, which if there's damage to DNA, it can be repaired. And then finally, there can be active regulation of a robust system so that it develops in a consistent way. So there are many routes to the robustness which can be used in conjunction or can be used quite separately. Now, if we now look at more examples of behaviour, this is a famous study that was done by a Dutch ornithologist called Perdik. He captured starlings, European starlings, in the north of Europe, and released them. He, after putting bands on their legs, he released them, and they flew off in a southwesterly direction, just like the garden warblers. However, when they got to somewhere like Holland, they would change their orientation and fly in a westerly direction, taking them into the United Kingdom and to Ireland. That is a very consistent pattern of the migration of these starlings. Now, what Perdik did, which was a very interesting thing to do, he separated the young birds, which never migrated before, from the adults. So they would then release on their own. And what he then found was that these birds, which were not flying with experienced adults, flew off in a southwesterly direction, and they didn't actually make that change in their course. He concluded from that these birds actually learned from their parents in their first season of migration to make that course shift when they reach a particular point in migration. They switch from going southwest to going west. In fact, flying straight out from the ground into France can be bad news for the birds because they allow them to be eaten by humans, that is. So there's a strong selection pressure not to go on into France. Another example is this fish eagle, the osprey, which when it's adult is very remarkable. If you ever see an osprey catching fish, it will dive into the water and grab a large fish and then fly off with it, as you can see in the picture. Now, this is a skill. The young birds have many of the motor patterns which were required for catching fish, but they're not very good at it. And you see young ospreys flying over lakes and making a complete mess of it. And quite a lot of them die as a result of not being able to fish properly. And they won't breed until they can fish properly. So there's a long period of acquiring that skill, even though they have some of the motor patterns present to begin with. So again, we have robust behavior, which is then superimposed on it a good deal of plasticity. So we start to see more and more examples of where we're getting both robust mechanisms, which also involve a good deal of plasticity. If we go to the human smile, this is Prime Minister of the UK getting a rather inhibited English smile. Here's the Emperor of Japan, also getting rather an inhibited smile. Here is the former French president, I think nervously anticipating losing the election. Here, of course, President Obama getting a very characteristic broad American smile. And then, very interestingly, here's a blind man, who's been blind since birth. He started to smile correctly at 5 or 6 weeks, but you can see there's something rather stereotyped about that smile. It's not quite the smile of a sighted person. And this is not a careful bit of research, it's just to kind of give you an illustration of the cultural variation in smiling, and also how the blind don't quite develop in the same way as sighted people. So again, a similar sort of argument. You start out in a very robust way, and then you get a lot of change during subsequent development. Now, sometimes people think, well, when a child reaches a certain period of development, and if it is exhibiting behavior that dictates shortly after birth, that it can't possibly have learnt it. Well, there was a very important study, I think, done by De Casper and Pfeiffer some time ago, about 30 years ago now, in which he made use of the fact that if you put a dummy in the mouth of a baby, they will start to suck on it. And what you can do is to see whether they will change the rate of sucking when they hear their mother's voice. And so if they hear their mother's voice, they suck at a higher rate. Or if they suck at a lower rate, they hear the voice of another woman. And what the babies do, these are neonates, is that they suck at a higher rate to hear their mother's voice. And of course, I mean, the good scientists, De Casper and Pfeiffer, the balanced design so that some of the babies had to suck at a lower rate in order to hear their mother's voice. And indeed, that's what they did. So they actually, before birth, they'd acquire something from their mother's voice. If you put a microphone inside the uterus of a woman and she talks, you can hear what she's saying. So the baby is being exposed to the sounds of her mother's voice. Anyway, the Catherine Pfeiffer then went on to do a very interesting and important additional experiment in which they took another lot of mothers, and during the last 3 months of the mother's pregnancy, the mother read every day to the child a story, same story. And then the same design as before, but now they were given a choice between the mother reading the familiar story or the mother reading another story, and to see whether the babies actually recognized the familiar story. And what the babies did was actually they sucked at a lower rate to hear the familiar story and didn't suck at a higher rate to hear the unfamiliar story. And again, they balanced it so that so other babies had to suck at a higher rate to hear the familiar story. So during that last period of pregnancy, the fetus was actually learning the characteristics of sounds that the mother was making and actually preferred them to unfamiliar sounds told by their mother. So clearly in this case, learning during fetal development had occurred, and so being present at birth didn't mean to say that it wasn't learned. So this is an important piece of work. Now,
sorry, Pat, I didn't get one thing. Is it clear they're not learning during the course of the experiment?
During the course of what?
Of this experiment?
They were learning prior to the test. They were near me, so they were tested. So the mothers hadn't read it sort of after the birth. So they had to have learned it before they were born.
But aren't they being rewarded in some fashion here by the way the experiment is designed?
Sorry, I didn't understand.
Are they not being rewarded? So, for example, if they suck at a higher rate there, they get to hear the mother reading the familiar story?
If they suck at a higher rate, in the second case, they hear the familiar story. If they suck at a lower rate, they hear another story told by their same mother. But they've never heard that story before.
True. So doesn't this constitute a learning experiment?
This is a learning experiment, yes.
This in itself, but this is post-birth.
But the learning took place. Sorry, I'm losing my voice. The learning took place before birth. They had no opportunity to hear the story after birth. But when they were tested, they recognised the familiar story.
Did he hear? Did he learn?
No,
the story about they were in the womb.
Sorry.
Yeah, so can I just add to that? So they are being rewarded for either of the two, for both of the two behaviors, but they prefer one of them over the other. So the reward is for both of them. So whether they suck higher or lower, they're hearing stories in both cases, but they nevertheless prefer to choose one reward over the other.
Which is the one that they choose?
The
familiar story.
In both cases, they choose the familiar story. I mean,
well, that's
the group on the right had to suck the lower rate to hear the familiar story. The group on the left had to suck at a higher rate. So it's balanced design. Now, if you look at plasticity, it's not a homogeneous category, and there are many different types of plasticity. One that, in her book on plasticity in development and evolution, Mary Jane West-Ewhart makes a point about there's a famous goat which had lost its forelimbs and was going around its rear limbs. And as a result of that, it developed a particular kind of musculature for walking about on two legs. And in fact, if you go to YouTube and look up bipedal dogs, you'll see pictures of this little dog and some others too, which have lost their forelimbs. And they're amazingly proficient. I mean, they can run around on two legs very well. And again, this will have many consequences for the development of their muscles and their skeleton. So this is what Mary Jane West-Ewhart called accommodation, one form of plasticity. There's lots of neural plasticity, and I'll show you a remarkable example in a moment. In early development, there may be various kind of accidents could occur, the fetus can make adjustments to those accidents and show considerable plasticity. More remarkably, and I'll talk about this more in a moment again, the baby can pick up cues from the mother, which it can then use in how it subsequently develops. And I'll describe the details in a moment, but it's assuming, as it were, that the environment is autocorrelated. So if the conditions of the mother's environment is of a particular kind, then the conditions for her offspring will be of the same kind. And so they use the cues from the mother to determine how they subsequently develop. I'll tell you more about that in a moment. And then there's all the kind of plasticity which you find in the immune system. So that, I mean, when we're vaccinated, we develop a response specifically to the antigen which we've been exposed to. And that's the whole basis of the immune response, the plastic immune response. And then, of course, there's all sorts of different kinds of learning which can be involved in categorization, doing all sorts of things, which in fact we heard about from yesterday in terms of cognitive development. So there are many, many different types of learning. Now, these processes are not all the same, and there may be others which I haven't included there, which indicate that plasticity is not a unitary phenomenon, and we need to be attuned to that. Now, look at this example of plasticity in the brain. This is a scan of a normal human being showing their brain. And this is a scan of a person who early in life had hydrocephaly, and the whole of the central part of the brain, the cerebrospinal fluid is expanded and forced the cortex into a thin layer round. And the extraordinary thing about this particular case, and there are several of them, they develop normally. I mean, providing the disease occurs sufficiently early in life, you wouldn't know, apart from that having a rather large head, you wouldn't know that these people had a completely different structure to their brain. And this particular man, I mean, he held down a perfectly normal white-collar job, I don't think he had a particularly high IQ, but he was, nonetheless, you wouldn't have recognized him being abnormal. So there's an extraordinary degree of plasticity possible in the brain, particularly if the damage takes place early in development. Here's a botanical example of plasticity, on a family holiday in Greece, in a place called Kefalonia, which is a lovely island, there's a particular fir which grows there. And so I dug up two tiny little saplings and put them in my sponge bag, took them back to England. One of them was planted in the garden, and now 30 years later it's turned into a magnificent tree. The other I put into a small pot it's still alive, and it's doing okay, but it's tiny. It's like a little bonsai. And just to compare the two, and here's the two, and now you can see the difference in size. Perfectly able to produce fir cones, and perfectly able to reproduce the small one, but the incredible plasticity of this plant enables it to develop in quite different ways. Another nice example is this particular species, which can either grow on land or grow in water, and when it grows on land, has a different structure from when it is grown in water. And in the experiment, what was done was to take plants which have been grown on land and put them, either transplant them either into land or into water. And the same was done with the ones that have been grown in water. And so we've got these four conditions: land, water, land. And once they're fully developed, they can't change. They're not plastic at that stage, and so when they're transplanted into an environment which they were not grown in initially, they die. So again, early plasticity is important, leads to very different phenotypic characteristics, but once they're established, then it can't be changed. And of course something can be changed, but this is a very striking one where it couldn't be changed. Another famous example, which goes back actually to the beginning of the 20th century, but a lot of work has been done on it, is a little water flea, Daphnia, tiny, about a millimetre or so in size. And this is a water flea which has been taken in from water where there were no predators. And it looks like this. If you then take other Daphnia from water where there are predators, which is the main predator on Daphnia is a midge, and the young Daphnia actually held inside the body cavity of the mother, but when they come out of the body cavity, they look quite different, and they have this extended spike on their tail and kind of armor plating on the head, and we know now that what triggers this is if the mother is exposed to the crushed remains of Daphnia, from which is produced by the predators eating Daphnia, a cue is transmitted to the offspring, and the offspring then develop in a quite different way. Interestingly, there is a cost to doing this, in that the Daphnia, which produces armor plating, the females don't produce so many eggs. There's a nutritional cost to the young. But of course, it's better to survive and produce fewer young yourself than not to survive at all. So, I mean, this clearly has a real benefit. So that's a famous example of again, plasticity, in this case, in an invertebrate. So what we see here are examples where different phenotypes can be produced from the same genotype. And the phenotypes, in the good cases, match the environment to which they're well adapted, which are sort of represented by the kind of the match between the phenotype and the environment. But there are also bad cases where, for example, the environment changes, where the phenotype does not match the environment. And I'll give you a clear example from our own species, which is a very remarkable one, where the mismatch can actually be quite serious for the individual. And this work comes from studies initially started by David Barker, who's an epidemiologist, and he found that the fetus, the human fetus, is very sensitive to the maternal condition. And so if the mother was in good nutritional health, the babies were born large, and if she in relatively poor nutritional state, they were born much smaller. And so there was big variation in the size of the baby at birth, and many other things as well, as we now know, in terms of their capacity to cope with rich food. If you then expose the big babies to an environment where there's lots of food, I mean, which I've sort of done by this cartoon here, they develop well, and barring accidents and barring ill health, they will develop to become healthy old people. If you do the same thing with the small babies, quite different pattern of development, and these small babies exposed to a highly nutritional rich diet tend to become obese. They tend to get heart disease. This was established very early on in this work by David Barker. In addition to heart disease, they develop type 2 diabetes. And I believe here in India that type 2 diabetes has become more or less epidemic. I mean, very large numbers of people, about 70 million people, have type 2 diabetes. Well, I presume that's because many people have been born small and then exposed to an affluent diet and then suffer the consequences. When we look at the other cases, for example, small babies brought up in an environment where there's nothing on superoxide shelves, there's relatively low nutrition in their diet, they develop perfectly normally and develop to a ripe old age. So they don't suffer if they're in an environment which kind of matches the environment of their mother. And interestingly, and this work establishes the point that this is adaptive, if the big babies are exposed to famine, where there's very little food around, they may die, or in extreme famine conditions, or develop rickets, vitamin D deficiency disease, which means that, particularly for women, if you get rickets in early in life, it's very difficult for you to breathe later on, very difficult for you to have babies. So what we here see here is as well the good cases and the bad cases. So that the mother's cue generally will provide valuable information for her offspring. But if the environment changes, as it often does now, I mean, when countries go through a rapid period of economic development, there can be many bad cases where the child's phenotype is not well adapted to an affluent environment. I mean, that raises its important public health issues, which are now being followed up on. So here you see again plasticity early in life having a profound effect on our own species.
How was this experimented?
It was done in it was a good epidemiologist who did it initially, looking at the birth rates of babies, and then able to follow up and see what happens to them much later in life. And the ones who had been born small, who grew up in a very affluent environment, they were the ones who developed heart disease. So that was the initial study of Gay Park. But there's been lots of experimental work done, not only in humans, but also in animals. And it's very much out of your mind.
You said that you presume that this could happen in the Indian population. Actually, such studies have been carried out indeed in Pune in collaboration with Bhaskar Group by a diabetician. And it bears the fact that, you know, low birth babies do have diabetes.
Do have
more incidence of type 2 diabetes.
Yeah, exactly.
That has been shown in India.
Yeah, I know. And I mean, this is a big area of research now. And David Bach, as you say, did work here in India.
Yes.
There's lots of experimental work done on animals as well. I mean, it's a field known as developmental origins of health and disease, and the whole journal is devoted to it. It's a big field. Anyway, all that said, I mean, we have clear examples of robustness, clear examples of plasticity, and sometimes people have made attempt using populations to distinguish between what they think of the additive contributions of the genetic and environmental sources of variation. And if you take examples easy to measure, like human height, the height of adults, here's an example of somebody from Northern Europe and two Congolese pygmies. And however well fed those pygmies are, they'll never become as tall as the Europeans. And in fact, they're less sensitive to growth hormones, so this is the reason why they have a much smaller stature. There's a clear genetic difference between the Congolese and the Northern Europeans. And at the same time, we know that height is very sensitive to nutrition. And if you look you can do this study all over the world, but if you take, for example, the male height in the UK, which has been measured carefully over many years, what you find is that there's been a strong secular trend upwards, and this is in males, and nowadays you see many, many tall men. The effect is kind of leveling off a bit now, so it's not going to go on forever. But there's a clear responsiveness to good nutrition. The effect in women has been smaller. It was about a third of that of what you see in men. But that even in women now it's accelerating. So you now see many tall women, particularly young women now, which you wouldn't have seen a few years ago. So here again is a strong environmental influence operating on height. Now, we've got two clear effects, and what is done then with populations is attempt to partition the variance in height in relation to the genetic background, in relation to the environment. And if you do that, in theory at least, you can have the high genotypes like the Northern Europeans who are consistently taller than the low genotypes like the pygmies. But both groups are also affected by the environment. And if this were perfectly true, then you could measure the difference in variance between the high genotypes and low genotypes. You can also get a measure of the total variance, and then derive a measure of what's called heritability, which is the genetic variance divided by the total variance. You can see all sorts of reasons why this ratio might not actually be very accurate. And indeed, it is the case that that there is an interaction between the genotype and the environment. So that instead of getting the purely additive effect, where the two conditions could be disentangled in the adult phenotype, you get an interactive effect, which leads to a phenotype which can't be disentangled in terms of the variance of the total population. And so you get an effect more like that, where the high genotype and low genotype are both relatively small at low environmental conditions, and they diverge as the environment conditions improve. And so if that's the case, it's very difficult to know how you'd ever get a ratio, because where do you measure the genetic variance? So it's a questionable measure. It can be used under very limited circumstances, particularly in plant and animal breeding studies, but as a general concept, I mean, if you talk about the heritability of IQ, it doesn't mean anything very much, except in very limited conditions. And we see some very startling examples now, and I was just simply saying that you can't calculate a heritability ratio. If you look at the 5-hydroxytryptamine genotypes, the molecules come either as long molecules or short molecules. And you get both types in the human population. And if you look at the effects of parenting on these different genotypes and see how prone the child is to upset by trauma, there's not much effect if you look at the genotypes which have two long molecules, or they're heterozygous and they have one long and one short. However, if you look at the ones which have got two short ones, homozygous for that, they're enormously influenced by poor parenting, and this involves harsh treatment and a lot of things which we recognise as being poor parenting. But if you then look at the offspring of good parents, they're very resilient, and they show very little proneness to upset by trauma. So here again, there's a very, very strong interaction in populations between the genotype and environment, which I mean, I think should make anybody who takes heritability estimates too seriously, should give them pause for thought. So when one moves from, instead of looking at populations, one looks at individual development, there's a lot of integration between robustness and plasticity. And I'll give you two famous examples from classical work, which show just how this happens. This is work done by Peter Marler when he was working on the west coast of the States. And he was looking at the dialects of white-crowned sparrows. Any good bird watcher can hear the differences in dialect. And you may not be able to read these sound spectrograms, but you can see that this pattern is clearly very different from this pattern in the song. There are many studies that have been done like this since the first work. This shows that there's a lot of variation within a particular species in the kind of song they produce. The person who got this work sort of really get started was W.H. Thorpe in Cambridge, where he worked on the chaffinch. Now, if you look at the chaffinch song, you can see that this kind of flourish at the end of the song. This is the plotting the pitch of the song against time. And you get this rapid series of syllables followed by this kind of flourish at the end. What Thorpe did was to take tape recording of the wild chaffinch song and paste it into the middle of the recording. So the flourish now is in the middle of the song rather than at the end. He then hand-reared chaffinches and exposed them to recordings of the re-articulated song. And then when the young birds which had been hand-reared were allowed to sing, or when they sang perfectly normally, when they were adults, what happened was that they produced songs like that. So the birds had learned the characteristics of the recording and had you see the flourish is now being put into the middle of that song. So they clearly had been affected by their experience. And the interesting thing about the Wild Jaffet song is you can't teach them anything. They're considerable constraints on what they can be taught. But nonetheless, within those constraints, they're very plastic. Now, some birds are actually extremely plastic, and the Indian hill miner is a remarkable example of a bird which requires a very wide range of different songs. Another classic experiment, this is one from my own laboratory, on behavioural imprinting. And you can take a chick or a duckling about a day after it's hatched, been kept in the dark, put in a wheel, such as you see here, and exposed to a very conspicuous object. It's kind of flashing light, which is bright red, and the flashes as it turns. And the birds are very attracted by this, and they when you put them in these wheels, they're highly motivated and can travel something like a sort of kilometre in the course of an hour. And they're very strongly motivated to approach these things. And while they're doing that, they learn the characteristics of it. They become imprinted. Now, we thought it was important to see whether there was any kind of constraint on what they would approach. And so we used the stuffed ancestor of the domestic chick, the Southeast Asian jungle fowl. And this was put on a turntable and it rotated. Again, the chicks were very attracted to it. And they were particularly attracted to the head and the neck, which actually made the jungle fowl more attractive to the birds than the flashing red light. So if you remove the head and neck from the stuffed bird, then there's no difference. It's particularly this particular feature which they find especially attractive. So they start out with very strong predispositions. They then learn the characteristics, as you can see here. This is first of all showing the response of naive birds, which have never learned anything so far. And if they, in this case, if they showed a strong preference for the red light, they would have a zero preference. They should have a very strong preference for the red box, sorry, for the jungle fowl. They would be 100. You can see if they showed no preference, it would be 50%. But in fact, it's about 60%. So you can see from that quantification of their preferences that they are showing a preference for the jungle fowl when it's got a head on it. If you take the head off, there's no preference. Now, you expose to another group of chicks for 60 minutes to the jungle fowl, and you see an increase in their preference. This is the typical imprinting response of the bird's behavior. They're showing an increase in the preference for the thing that they've been exposed to. And conversely, if you expose them for 60 minutes to the red box, it goes the other way, and they're now starting to show a preference for the red box. Eventually, the process becomes extremely, leads to a very, very robust preference, which is very difficult to change later on. So what you get here is a strong predisposition, with certain features being more important than others, followed by plasticity, and then ending up with a very robust outcome. So the processes of robust, well-canalized responses interacting with the plastic mechanisms, and then leading at the end to a very, very robust outcome. So these two cases show very nicely that although the processes are certainly regulated by quite robust rules, once completed, their outcomes tend to be highly robust. And in the case of birdsong, once they acquire song early life, many species show a very robust repertoire, which can be difficult to change. So here we see these things closely intertwined. Now, this then sort of leads on to the whole area of developmental biology known as epigenetics. And as many of you know, Conrad Warrington produced a book in 1957 called The Strategy of the Genes. And he called the field where we're talking about the interaction between the developing organism and its environment, he called the field epigenetics. And in the sort of years following, I just did a very kind of crude account of a number of papers which had epigenetics in their title. And in 1960, just following the sort of publication of Warrington's book, there were just four papers. In 1970, there were four papers. In 1980, it started to go up 13 papers. 1990, 48 papers. 2000, it's now it's gone up tenfold to 415. And 2010, it's gone up to 3,577. And it's going up. I mean, part of this is just kind of fashion. I mean, but nonetheless, it indicates an enormously rapidly growing field. Most of it's molecular, I should say. I mean, there's not a great deal of work going on at the behavioral level. But nonetheless, there's an enormous growth of interest in this whole field. And some of it is purely fashion, but a lot of it is telling us an awful lot about the nature of the underlying mechanisms. And I mean, in a sense, the phenomena has been known about for a long time. I mean, clearly, in cell differentiation, you can get nerve cells, you can get epithelial cells, you can get muscle cells, you can get bone cells, and they tend they behave very differently, of course. They look very different, and yet they contain the same genetic information. And the cells clearly are products of events during development, which determine which genes are turned on and which genes are turned off. And we've doubtless be hearing much more about this in the course of the meeting. And what's interesting is that the cells can maintain their phenotype for long periods, and the daughter cells carry the same characteristics as the parent cell. So you get these different cell lines, which are very robust once they're formed. And now the question becomes, you know, what is the nature of the mechanism by which some genes are turned on, some genes are turned off? Each of those cells has a different combination of genes which are turned on and turned off. And the first of the processes to be studied, which is now quite well known, is, I mean, if you look at the chromosome, on the chromosome, you have a string of chromatin, and each, there are nucleosomes on the chromatin, and the way in which they're linked can be changed by histone modification or by methylation. This is just one of many mechanisms, but when, for example, a particular gene is methylated, the molecules close up and transmission is impeded. When they're open, transmission is possible. So, I mean, this mechanism is well understood. I mean, there are people in this room who know much more than I do about this, but that just to emphasize that here we're deciding to understand very well some of the molecular mechanisms which are involved, so that methylation itself can actually play a very big role in which genes are being expressed and which genes are not being expressed. And here's an interesting case from some years back of a baby which has got a cancer in one of his eyes here. And in this case, the methylation of the cytosine and guanine ions in the genome This is a major contributing factor to mutation in a gene. And if that gene is methylated, it's effectively inactivated, it leads to the probability of cancer. Interesting point that what only one eye is affected. I mean, so there are other factors which are involved here, but the gene which when it's inactivated, leads to this cancer. Is obviously very important in whether the child develops it. So, an interesting example of methylation. Another very nice example comes from work on mice. And in this case, it was a strain of mice which had been, there was a transposon, a viral transposon, which had been introduced into the mouse genome. And when that's done, they become yellow. And what was done was to take yellow mice and feed the mothers with a methyl supplement. Now, it didn't always work, but what you can see clearly is that some of the yellow mice had that transposon methylated and they're brown, they're like the wild type. The methylation didn't always work and these ones are yellow. But what was very nice about this study was that once you've done it to one generation, then the offspring bred true. So here we have the yellow ones. Because they're sharp too well, but I think you can see that the yellow ones are breeding true as yellow, and the brown ones, where the transposon has been methylated, are brown. So it's crossing generations, which is itself a very important finding. Well, there are many other epigenetic mechanisms. We should probably hear much more about them. We heard a bit about microRNA yesterday. A large part of the genome, which has been described as junk in the past, actually is involved in producing the microRNAs, which are extremely important in regulation of gene expression. And one study, which I cited there, showed that if you injected mice with microRNA and then followed them through several generations, heart growth was affected in subsequent generations. So the microRNA was actually being transmitted through three generations of mice in this particular case. Now, many other studies like this now coming forward and showing that you can get transmission of epigenetically induced effects from one generation to the next. So this raises, how does this impact on evolution? And there's a very interesting paper published 2 years ago that showed that genetic mutations are strongly linked to sites where there's been epigenetic change. And these are most likely to occur in the cytosine and guanine islands in the genome. So mutation isn't necessarily random, but can be induced by an epigenetic effect. Now, this has interesting consequences, and it's not quite Lamarckian in any kind of extreme sense. But you can get interesting effects in the evolution. So that if you start off at the top here, an environmental event leads to an epigenetic change, which is adaptive, the phenotype is adaptive environment. Now that may be transmitted on to the next generation by non-genetic means, by epigenetic means, or it may be that the environmental events recur, and you get the same phenotype being adapted. If this goes on, you may get then mutations occurring at the sites of epigenetic change, which doesn't lead necessarily to the same phenotype, it does lead to phenotypic variation. And as a result of that, then you can get a process of normal Darwinian evolution taking place, and you get differential survival of phenotypes which are best adapted to the environment. And that, of course, leads to genetic inheritance. So what you get here is an indirect way in which epigenetic events can actually lead to genetic inheritance, which is, is new. I mean, this is really interesting from a point of view of thinking about evolution. So, in summary, I mean, obviously, both genes and environment affects the characteristics of the whole organism, and the whole organism develops behavior of a kind. And what we now see is that the state of the whole organism can impact on which genes are being expressed, and this can have a substantial effect on the phenotype of that individual. And to add to that, you can get behavior affecting the environment. So you can get what's sometimes known as niche picking, where the animal actually chooses the environment it's the best adapted to. And that this can then feed into the whole system. So instead of sort of thinking in a very crude way about genes and environment producing the phenotype, you now have a much more interesting kind of network going on. And I mean, this is very simplified, of course, but it gives you a sense of how we're moving away from kind of crude dichotomies to a much more systems oriented approach to development. So a lot of this is written up in a little book by Peter Brookman and myself, which anybody wants to have a look at, it's here, and you can borrow it. I mean, particularly the description of the different types of robustness and different types of plasticity and how they're intertwined, I think might be of interest. And some of the epigenetics is being rapidly superseded, but the general are still valid. There are some lessons from this. Firstly, the population approaches, which are engaged in uncovering sources of variance, should be clearly distinguished from studies of mechanism involved in the development of individuals. So, the studies which were used in what I think are rather dubious examples of heritability estimates, those studies are clearly different from trying to look at the nature of the mechanism. So that's one important lesson to take on board. The second, I think, is that there are a whole series of metaphors which have been used to describe what's going on in development. In neurobiology, you very often see metaphors derived from engineering, and people talk about hardwiring of the system, particularly applied to the nervous system. And then from computational science, we have the notion of programming, which describes genes. Again, I think very misleadingly, I think talking about genetic programming is not a clever way of thinking about development. And then, of course, from architecture, another metaphor is the notion of blueprints, which also apply to genes. And all these metaphors usually imply dichotomies. And I think they're best not used, because they actually are slipping back into an earlier form of thinking, which we should try and abandon. So, to conclude, I think it's probably the case that the widespread use of instinct and nature and nature of nurture thing may simply be a feature of kind of folk biology and folk psychology. We're all brought up on these ideas, and it's difficult to get rid of them. It's an unfortunate consequence of trying to simplify too much. In a way, the nature-nurture opposition was always a mistake. I mean, nature should really refer to the outcome of development, and nurture should refer to how any given nature is obtained. So it's a category mistake to oppose nature and nurture. And what epigenetics does is to tell us about the details of the developmental processes, and doubtless we should hear a lot more about this in the future. So, thanks to various people, the League of Human Trust has funded some of my work in the last 10 years. It was a grant jointly to me and Barry Cavone, and James Curley, who done empirical work, which I haven't been talking about, on mice, he was a collaborator of mine. And Peter Gluckman is a co-author of the book, this book here. So, thank you all very much. Thank you for listening.
The example is short as Sagittarius. If in the long term the climate is adapted to the terrestrial habitat, if they reintroduce later, losing what a village story had.
I believe that's the case. I mean, we know of many plants which have been adapted to the high rate of concentration of things like grass, which do seem to be able to cope better in included areas. And I don't know whether the experiments have been done, but I think what you're implying is if you take this back to a non-polluted environment, they wouldn't do very well. I think I'm sure that's true. And by the way, can you use a microphone if you ask a question? I think it helps always in a way.
Yes, I can't see the face of the person there at the back.
Again. So this is about the face washing of the rod.
Yeah, just wait a moment, please, until the mic is.
Afterwards inherited, is there any evidence where
these changes are adaptive to the existing environment?
Oh, yes. I mean, but the question is, do they persist? I mean, there are some botanical examples where they do persist over many generations. But many of the animal examples, they don't persist for more than a few generations. And so you'd have to reinduce them by the same environmental events later on if you wanted to maintain that adaptive change.
So if they are adaptive, do they not qualify the Lamarckism kind of concern?
Well, yes and no. I mean, Lamarck has often been caricatured. I mean, he didn't say everything that he was accused of saying. But in the sense that, if you've got strong arms as a result of being a blacksmith, say, working on, it doesn't necessarily follow that your children are going to have big arms. I mean that's the kind of caricature of Lamarck. Now, in the case of where we have adaptive changes following from an environmental event leading to an inherited epigenetic event, in most of the cases that I know about, they don't persist for very long. The way in which it could lead to long-term effects, which I tried to illustrate in that slide, is that what can happen is that where there's been an epigenetic change in the genome, that's more likely to mutate. And as a result of that, you get a wide variety of possible phenotypes. And some of those phenotypes may be adaptive. So it's an indirect route. It's not a kind of direct effect, but it's an indirect effect. So I think that's the most likely way in which epigenetic changes can actually lead to something of evolutionary interest. But I mean, in the short term, there certainly are transgenerational effects which can persist for several generations.
Is it possible that in different environments, phenotypic plasticity is generated, so like you generate a different phenotype in a different environment, so after a certain threshold, that plasticity is lost? So you get the new phenotype becomes fixed, like in what Ingrid tells, assimilation and then canalization. So you lose plasticity, is it possible?
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. I mean, we have many examples of that. Where, I mean, the developmental effect, which shows a lot of plasticity, only persists for a certain stage of the life cycle. And after that, you no longer have the plasticity. I mean, many of the sensitive periods of development, which we see many of them, are of that kind. But the period of sensitivity is a period of plasticity, followed afterwards by no firm plasticity. So, yes. We saw very clearly, and there's some examples where once a particular phenotype has been formed, as in some of the cases of plants, they can't be changed in adulthood. So, these sensitive periods of effects are very, very powerful.
Okay. Is plasticity always advantageous to the individual, or? Say, for example, changes in dietary habits leading to carcinogenesis is also plasticity.
No, I mean, plasticity can be very bad for the individual. I mean, as we saw, if you're born small and you have metabolic adaptations to a low nutrition environment, and then you end up in an environment where there's lots of food, you're very bad, you're maladaptive to that environment. So, it doesn't necessarily be the case that it's adapted. But if there's a strong autocorrelation in the environment. So environment in time t is very strongly correlated with t plus 1 and so on. Then it can be highly adaptive.
Ellen?
I didn't quite understand your first conclusion, which was that population approaches should be distinguished from the study of mechanisms in development. Could you say something else about that? If you mean to intend anything about evolutionary developmental biology?
Well, I mean, the point is that if you're looking for sources of variance, that will say that something is likely to contribute making a lot of contribution to the variance in the phenotype, which can be helpful in looking at mechanisms, but it's not the same as looking at mechanisms. It's a first step, if you like. It's different from at what happens to the individuals as it develops. And so I think too much was made sometimes of the kind of the studies of variance, because when people talked about interaction in those cases, what they meant was not interaction in the sense that a developmental biologist talked about. What they meant was a statistical interaction. You do your analysis of variance, and you get an interaction term. And actually, that's not the same as talking about how mechanisms actually work. So, I mean, the other point actually to make is that when Fisher developed the analysis of variance, very, very important tool in agriculture and in psychology. But when he developed that tool, he was actually trying to get rid of a lot of the interaction. So if you go and look at some of the textbooks on this, they'll say if you're getting an interaction term, you can get rid of it by transforming the data. And so they're actually trying to get at additive effects. So what we see when we look at mechanism is anything but additive effects. I mean, interactions of a different kind. I mean, integrative mechanisms which are involved in taking account of all the kind of local influences. And that's not what the statisticians meant by interaction. So it's important to get those two bodies of thought separate from each other.
Might it help to say that when population genetic people speak of genotype environment interactions, they're really speaking of correlations, whereas in development you're looking for causal links?
Exactly. Yeah. Yanni?
Carlos?
Point of clarification, when people talk about the epigenetics that affect this gene and doesn't affect this other gene, is it fair to say that epigenetic mechanisms change momentarily, and it is almost impossible to check whether epigenetics acts or doesn't act, because when we do the experiments, may happen to happen that yes, there is hypermethylation or hypomethylation. Isn't this a dynamic event that prevents us from being sure that something is or is not genetically modified?
Well, I mean, my sense is that, I mean, you clearly, when you get the cell line being formed, I mean, clearly where the cell line stays as a strong cell line, there it's not momentary. It, you know, once it's, you know, you've got a cell line, then it stays like that. It stays as a nerve cell or whatever. So there we can actually say, yes, here there's been a change in the genome without changing the DNA, and some genes have been shut down, some not. But, I mean, your point is that maybe you're getting moment-to-moment changes in genes being expressed. I'm sure it's right. I mean, I think there are many things that go on, for example, in the nervous system, where the relatively quick changes can lead to structural changes, and then you no longer see the epigenetic effect. So I think you'll get all sorts of time changes that take place, some very dynamic, and some, once they've exerted their effect, they last a long time.
In your study involving big versus small babies, do you have any case of monozygotic twins, you know, wherein one of the babies is quite bigger than the other one? And would you expect them to follow the same pattern?
Monozygotic twins, where one baby was much larger than the other.
Yes, I mean, clearly there are a variety of things that can happen. Even though the animals are not, they have the same genes, exactly the same genes, but they may be in different parts of the uterus, and so they're exposed to different uterine conditions. And actually, there's now a good study showing that there are also epigenetic differences between those identical twins. So, yes. And this could be important, actually, in interpreting some of the twin studies, because people use twin studies a lot to try and get a source of the variation. Now we know that a lot of things going on during the uterus, which leads to quite big differences between the two sexes.
Yeah, I was just wondering, do you think it's possible that the persistence time of an epigenetic change might be under genetic control and correlated with sort of the persistence time of the relevant environmental factor? Has such a study been done?
I think it's clearly the case in some instances. You can get cell lines in culture, which can then be very robust, and they can maintain their characteristics. And I don't think that de-differentiation, which it can occur sometimes, very often it doesn't have to occur. I mean, it's very strong things going from mother cell to daughter cell and so on. So I don't think necessarily the case that you have to maintain the initial inducing conditions all the time. And sometimes it may be the case, but in many cases it's not, I think. You know, and particularly when you get these sensitive period effects. Exposure at one stage of early life can then lead to long-term effects, but you don't maintain that particular event early in life. So that was the inducing condition. And after that, you get other outcomes, which are very robust.
So what I meant was that if you have very rapid fluctuations in terms of your generation time, so let's say two generations versus 10 generations, then if something was fluctuating at the two generation frequency versus 10 generations, then an epigenetic change that was sensed, that was, you know, maintained for a two generation environmental effect, might be more adaptive than something that is for a 10 generational period.
It could be. I mean, you know, if the environment changed and you've got a phenotype which was now proving to be maladaptive, then it could be beneficial to actually then induce further plasticity. And we have some quite nice experimental studies. You mentioned yesterday how if you close off one eye in the cat, the other eye dominates the visual cortex. But if you expose those cats to noradrenaline much later in life, you can reinduce the plasticity. And so then our each eye powers equivalent dominance and the good status. So, that was done experimentally, but we have various sort of studies where, for example, human individuals who are exposed to something which is very stressful, and under those conditions, and if they're exposed to something new, they can actually change their preferences, they can change their behavior as a result of that. Some of the famous examples of so-called brainwashing included exactly that. I mean, these were people who had been very stressed, but also exposed to a new ideology. And then they come away effectively changing their behavior. And there's a lovely example which was given in a book called Battle for the Mind by Sargent, where he describes how in deep silence the preacher, before starting to preach, would pass around a live rattlesnake around the congregation. Which got them all very frightened, and then you would start. yes, you can reduce it.
Are there any experimental evidences for environmental epigenetics in environment-induced genotypic changes? And my other question is that how these changes are induced? Means it's quite obvious that there may be changes in the genome that which lead to the phenotype, but how could the changes in the epigenetic genome happen in the environment?
Two questions. Do you have experimental evidence for environment-induced epigenetic changes being inherited?
Yes. Yes. I mean, I gave some examples.
So that is like very broad experiment which you showed about the mice. So you had mice with the this methylation substrate, but that could be anything. So it is shown that some genes are permanently on or off epigenetic.
So is there a locus-specific effect that has been shown? An epigenetic, locus-specific epigenetic effect induced by the environment, which has then been inherited?
Yes, I mean, you don't have to maintain the environmental using event. I mean, there are many examples now where you induce an epigenetic change in one generation, don't do it again, but the effect persists over several generations, even though you haven't actually maintained the epigenetic medicine. So there are many examples of that. Yes.
So, like in case of DNA methylation, so it depends what type of epigenetic modifications are responsible for a specific phenotype. So, for DNA methylation, once it comes on CG sites, CG guided nucleotide sites, so then it does not require any inducer. So, in plants, in yeast, it's more. If you have a siRNA, short-end repairing RNA, just for a short time, which induces the DNA methylation, you don't require an initial inducer.
So that's an answer to Nat's question.
Just to follow up again on Monish's comment about the time for which the persistence of the epigenetic marker.
Yes.
There's some nice studies even with the Daphnia example that you gave where there is a grandmother effect.
Yes.
So if the chiromone is persisting when your Daphnia generations are quite short, the grandmothers will still have offspring with the helmet induced, even though the chiromone has been effectively removed. On the other hand, in tomato plants, for example, they only show one generation effect, so F1s, the F2s don't have it, where herbivory has induced more toxins in the seeds, and so the seeds planted have that enhanced cyanogenic glycoside. So there is a relationship.
And some of the botanical examples, I mean, there's one of the violets, for example, can show an epigenetic change, which then persists forever, as far as I can see. It behaves like a true genetic variant. So it can happen.
So shall we break up now and meet in exactly 15 minutes, please? We'll try and keep to the time today as far as possible.